From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Benjamin Bombard, sitting in for Doug Fabrizio. In late June 2013, a lightning strike ignited a fire on the outskirts of Yarnell, a small town in central Arizona. The 20 elite firefighters of the Granite Mountain Hotshots were the first on the scene sent in to fight the blaze. They worked hard to help get the fire under control, but then a thunderstorm suddenly kicked things into high gear. One fateful decision sealed the destiny of the Granite Mountain Hotshots, and when the smoke cleared, only one of their crew had survived. In a new book, the journalist and former firefighter Kyle Dickman tells the tale of the Granite Mountain Hotshots and the tragic fire that claimed their lives. Dickman says that knowing what happened at the Yarnell Hill fire could help us avoid similar tragedies in the hotter, drier, more fiery future predicted for the American West. Join us after the news. Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks. From KUER News in Salt Lake City, I'm Benjamin Bombard, sitting in for Doug Fabrizio. On June 30, 2013, the 20 men of the Granite Mountain Hotshots, an elite wildland fire crew, arrived in the central Arizona town of Yarnell. It was a short drive from their home base of Prescott. A lightning strike 2 days earlier had set off a fire, and it grew quickly. Conditions had rarely been better for a wildfire to grow into a deadly inferno. While Granite Mountain worked to contain the blaze, winds whipped the fire to a frenzy. For one reason or another, the crew boss, Eric Marsh, decided to lead his men from the relative safety of land that had already burned with little risk of it burning again. It was a fateful decision, and its ramifications lie at the heart of the journalist Kyle Dickman's new book, On the Burning Edge. It's about the Granite Mountain Hotshots, the men who made up the crew that would come to define their lives, and we're talking about it today. Kyle Dickman is a former editor at Outside Magazine, and he actually worked as a wildland firefighter for 5 seasons in California on the Tahoe Hotshots. So he knows what life is like out there on the fire line. His new book is called On the Burning Edge, A Fateful Fire and the Men Who Fought It. And he joins us today from the studios of radio station KBAC in Santa Fe, where he's based. Kyle Dickman, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So let's start with your personal experience with wildland fire. You fought fire for 5 summers in California, as I mentioned. How and why did you end up doing that work?
Well, I was a freshman in college, and my dad made a deal with me. He said, if you can get a job fighting fires, I'll buy you a car. And so I spent my spring semester applying for jobs instead of going to classes. And I got a 1988 Toyota Camry out of the deal and went down to Truckee, California to work on an engine crew.
And what did you take away from those years on fire? I mean, personally, we're going to get into a little later some of the unique challenges faced by wildland firefighters. Yeah. But how did you take to that?
Oh, I loved it. I mean, I was 18 at the time, and there was nothing better. You know, I was making a pretty good living as a freshman in college, and I was getting to work outside. I was getting paid to work out for 2 hours a day. I mean, the culture is sort of this intoxicating mix of testosterone and like to be an 18-year-old like kid and just to see that and get out and go out and fight fires and use chainsaws. And I mean, it was pretty great. I loved it.
And what did you learn about yourself out there fighting fire?
I was a wrestler in high school, and I've always sort of liked the physicality I've always liked to be physical, but fighting fire is really physical. And I guess what I learned is that I'm capable of working through the pain, because the thing about fighting fires is that you end up working, you know, you can work 16-hour shifts for 2 weeks straight, and it's really sort of an endurance test. Like, at some point, you really just want to stop fighting fires, but there's nothing you can do about it, so you just keep going.
And why a hotshot was the job you landed?
The hotshot crew was the job I wanted. Mm-hmm. So on the engine crew, I mean, there's a pretty clear hierarchy in the world of wildland firefighting, and hotshots are pretty close to the top of it. And on the engine that I worked for, there was a couple of guys who had been hotshots, and they would always tell me these great stories of, you know, fighting these enormous blazes and seeing 100 to 200-foot flames and getting to do these big burnout operations. And, you know, like I said, to be an 18-year-old kid and hear about this elite organization that I could be a part of, I mean, that's I was drawn to it immediately. And so the year I graduated college, that next summer, the first thing I did is I went and I applied to work for the Hotshot Crew and was pretty proud to get the job.
So can you give us a brief overview? We'll talk a little bit more about some of the challenges and the rewards of being a hotshot in fighting fire. But let's start with where you start the book, with the Granite Mountain Hotshots. Tell us about the crew. Just introduce us to him, if you will, and we'll dig in a little bit more a little later. Based in Prescott, Arizona.
Sure. So there are 107 hotshot crews nationwide. What made Granite Mountain sort of special or unique was that they were a municipal hotshot crew. So most hotshot crews are run by federal or state fire agencies. And like I said, you know, earlier, there's a lot of hierarchy with the hotshots. And so I think when the Granite Mountain hotshots became a hotshot crew, a lot of the other crews sort of had a chip on their shoulder mm-hmm. about them. And they said, mm-hmm. well, you're a municipal crew. You know, we're used to working with the feds or the states. And so I think they had, right from the beginning, they really felt they had to prove themselves to the other fire organizations.
And the crew is made up of pretty mixed bag, a former bull rider, mm-hmm. couple ex-Marines, a football player, some kids from Southern California.
Yeah, that's the great thing about hotshot crews. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's pretty typical that you have a big slice of diverse people. Like, for instance, the crew that I worked on, I remember working beside one guy who had quit a job making $100,000 a year in finance to work as a hotshot. Mm-hmm. And next to him was a guy who got the job out of from an inmate crew. He'd spent 3 years in prison because of an armed robbery. And so you do get that sort of diversity on a hotshot crew. And with Granite Mountain, there was some of that. But what made them even more unique was the fact that a lot of the guys were from Prescott. Most of the guys were white. Most of the guys were sort of middle class and had grown there, and a lot of them were religious. And so they were sort of a community-oriented crew, and that was unique in the world of hotshots.
And you also write that they were more family-oriented than most hotshot mm-hmm. crews. There's a couple babies on the way.
Oh, many, yeah. I think, I can't remember the number exactly, but I think there was 11 kids between all of the hotshots. A lot of the guys would go to church together, and a lot of them were married or wanted to get married, and many of them were setting up their homes in the Prescott area. And I think for a lot of other hotshot crews are, you know, made up of guys who were more like me, who were 18, 19, 20, 25, and who took the job as a way to make money and have a great adventure, and then, head out and travel the world and go skiing in the winter. And I think on Granite Mountain, they saved their money and bought houses or, you know, took care of their children. And so it was different.
And some of these guys are also looking to make fire a career as well, right?
A lot of them were, yeah. So what attracted them, like I said, you know, they were a municipal crew. And what attracted many of the hotshots to work for Granite Mountain was that they could move up through the ranks. So whereas on a federal crew, you're in a federal firefighting system, and ultimately you're going to be a federal firefighter. But on the Granite Mountain hotshots, they were working for the city. And so they could, a lot of the guys were trying to jump from the wildland division into a structural firefighting job, which pays better and allows them to travel less. And I think for family-oriented guys, that mattered.
Mm-hmm. And so you introduced the book, actually, in the first few pages with this training exercise that Granite Mountain undertook at the beginning of the 2013 fire season. Mm-hmm. And we mentioned his name earlier, Eric Marsh. He was the crew superintendent. He was injured at the time, sustained a shoulder injury while mountain biking. And so Jesse Steed took the lead on the crew. Tell us about mm-hmm. Jesse Steed. He was the picture-perfect hotshot, you say.
Oh, yeah. He was this ex-Marine. He was, I think, 6'4", 250 pounds, just all muscle, you know, huge guy, fast, strong. And he was older than a lot of the hotshots, but everybody sort of looked up to him, not just because he was the physical leader, but like we've been talking about, there was a community-oriented crew, and Steed had this beautiful wife, and he had these two beautiful kids, and I think, you know, a lot of the guys wanted to emulate him, and he was just a natural leader. So yeah, he took the crew, and a lot of the men immediately coalesced around him, and they, you know, said, well, we want to be like Steed.
Mm-hmm. And he took them out on a training exercise at the beginning of the season. Tell us about that. The Granite Mountain Hotshots were basically fighting a simulated wildland fire. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So the idea is that you want to, you know, fire crews need to meet a minimum standard of skills. And so they have to show their overhead, you know, their chiefs or whatever, that they're capable of meeting that standard. And so this drill was meant to mimic a lot of the behaviors that you'll see in a wildfire. And so they went out and you hang these little ribbons around in the forest, and the hotshots would go out and they use chainsaws and their hand tools to cut line around this fake fire. Of course, the fire, you know, these fake fires never quite go right. And so, because the idea is that you need to test everything that you know. And so this fake fire, explodes, and there's suddenly spot fires, and it's running up the hill, and ultimately the hotshots have to deploy their fire shelters. So these aluminum blankets that they flick out and crawl under, and these blankets are heat shields, and they're designed to deflect, you know, the most intense heat. And so, like, of course, these are the blankets that the men die under at Yarnell Hill. And so, yeah.
Let's break that down a bit. So they're out there fighting a simulated fire, and you mentioned that they were digging line, cutting trees. Explain what you mean by that. There's a lot of terminology in the world of wildland fire,
yes.
And it all has to do with containing fires, right?
Right. So cutting line is, the idea is that you're going to remove the flammable material from the edge of the fire. And so when the fire hits this line, this fuel break, it no longer has trees or brush or even leaf litter or pine needles to burn. And so it stops spreading. And so a fire line will look like it looks like a highway with basically a jeep trail that's clear of all the way down what's called mineral soil, so mm-hmm. dust. And so the fire will stop as soon as it hits that line.
And they're just digging, they're just down there with tools, just pure brute force to break it down.
Yeah, I mean, it's it really, the job has not changed quite that much since 1910, which is when we really started fighting fires. And I mean, it's still a job. You know, hotshots work with the things that they can carry in their hands, and that's chainsaws, and that's hand tools like Pulaskis, and you know, they're called rhinos or shovels and rakes, and it's not the job itself is not that much different than a chain gang.
Mm-hmm. And there's another member of the crew. Well, there are several men out there fighting this simulated fire, but another guy that you spend quite a bit of time with in your book is Grant McKee. He's a rookie firefighter. And in some ways, it seems you kind of cast him as the polar opposite of Jesse Steed, a kid from Southern Orange County, California, likes sleeping in and taking it easy. Tell us about Grant.
Yeah, I think you're right that he is sort of the polar opposite to Steed. He didn't really necessarily want to be a hotshot. He wanted to be a paramedic, and he was a homebody. He liked being home with his girlfriend. He loved his dog. He liked good food and movies. And he got into the job because his cousin, Robert Caldwell, was the squad boss on the Grand Mountain Hotshot, so a position of some power. And Robert had really encouraged Grant to get the job because he could use it as a stepping stone to get a paramedic's job down the road. But Grant didn't really like it. I mean, he didn't necessarily thrive on the physicality of it. He didn't like the hazing that went on. He missed his girlfriend Leah whenever they went on road trips, and so I think he found the whole experience really uncomfortable.
And that day out on the simulated fire, Jesse Steed, he as you mentioned, he was quite a physical specimen, and he was pretty pitiless in how he meted out the physical challenges on his crew. Talk about that a bit.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's pretty common in the world of hotshots, because you have to be. I mean, the idea is that if Grant or anybody else couldn't hang on the training fire, then what happens in a real fire if they get into a situation where they have to outrun the blaze or, you know, move quickly or whatever it may be? And so, so what happened is, you know, they were hiking up this hill, and Steed is leading the march, and they're moving faster than most people jog, and Grant McKee drops out. He falls out of the line, and they all hike in single file line, and
they're carrying 30-pound packs, 40-pound packs.
Yeah, 40, 45-pound packs. They're carrying chainsaws and their hand tools, and they're, you know, effectively, I mean, they're hiking, but it looks, for me, it's, you know, you have to jog. So they're moving pretty quickly, and Grant falls off the back of this line, and he's like down on his knees, and he's puking, and all of the guys behind him, it's like a dog eat dog world, and they sort of fall around him, and they're like, get up, you know, and like everybody's yelling and cussing at him, and it's a little bit like the military. Mm. And it's sort of at that point that, you know, Grant makes this decision. He used to be a wrestler in high school, and so and he doesn't quit. I mean, he's got this he's he's a tough kid. He may not love the work that he's doing, but he's decided that he's going to do it. And so it's at that moment that he's like, well, you know what? I signed up for this. I'm not going to quit. And so he lugs this. He's carrying this, oh, I don't know, 30-pound box of water, lugs this box of water to his shoulders, and they chase Steed back up the hill.
And this is fun, you said. This
No. I don't know about that. I mean, parts of it are fun. I think it's more fun for the guys who have been a part of the crew for a while. I mean, for the rookies, they have to prove themselves, you know. And so it takes time to do that. So I don't know. Yeah, I don't. It's funny you say that. Now I look back at my time as a hotshot, and I'm wondering if I would describe it as fun. I would describe it as a great adventure with moments of fun and moments that were just not at all.
In your book, you mentioned some of the camaraderie that's built on a crew, and it sounds really like the experience itself, fighting fire. It sounds like the camaraderie that these guys build is pretty intense.
Well, I mean, it's a brotherhood is how they all describe it. I mean, you're out there. You can spend 2 weeks on the edge of a fire, and you see some pretty amazing things. And I think the bond forms over the fact that whatever you're going through, good or bad, you're going through together. Mm-hmm. And so they get, you know, they really get close. And, you know, I still stay in touch with a lot of the guys that I worked with. And that was, well, I don't know, 8-9 years ago. So, yeah.
So
you get very close.
Pardon, you mentioned a little earlier that this training day, it ends with something that would prove later to be a little ominous. The fire, the simulated fire that they were fighting, it turns out it wasn't really about putting that fire out. This was a test, and not on their not their ability to contain a fire. Talk about that.
Well, the idea is that they, like I said, they have to test every skill in their, you know, every tool in their kit, so to speak, and that just involves reacting to fires that are growing quickly. And, you know, firefighters just cannot control all the blazes that they try to fight. And in this case, they wanted to work a fire that they, even a fake fire that they knew they couldn't control. And so, at some point toward the end of the day, after they'd been working, you know, for 12 or 13 hours, they simulated the fire exploding and running uphill and the hotshots getting chased. And so they had to drop their packs and grab their fire shelters, which we talked about. And they sit in this little bread box sized kit in the bottom of their pack. And so they grab their fire shelters and their tool and the thing of water. And they're just sprinting up this hill. And at some point, Steed yells to the men. He says, deploy your shelters. And everybody has to clear all the brush out from around, you know, so anything that can burn that's right next to them. And they flick out their shelters, crawl under this thing. And then meanwhile, guys like Robert Caldwell, who was that squad boss that we talked about, and Steed grab the top of these shelters and they just shake them around to simulate the hurricane force winds that can accompany flaming fronts. So the idea is that, you know, they wanted to mimic the type of fire behavior and conditions that you'll see in a real wildfire.
And these shelters are basically aluminum pup tents. And are they effective?
They are effective. They're not designed to withstand direct contact with flame. So they don't, you know, they work in some conditions in some cases. And but if there isn't enough space between the fire shelter and the fire, then they're going to fail. And what happens is the aluminum sort of peels back and, you know, they become, there's a saying in the fire service, they call them shake and bake tents because, you know, like a popcorn reference.
That's Kyle Dickman. He's a journalist and a former wildland firefighter. His new book is called On the Burning Edge, A Fateful Fire and the Men Who Fought It. We need to take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Benjamin Bombard, sitting in for Doug Fabrizio. Today on the show, we're talking about a wildfire that burned in central Arizona in June of 2013. It claimed the lives of 19 elite firefighters, the Granite Mountain Hotshots. It was the most firefighters killed in the line of duty since 9/11, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. The journalist and former hotshot Kyle Dickman is our guest. He's written a new book that tells the story of the Yarnell Hill fire. It also offers a window into the intense world of wildland firefighting. His book is called On the Burning Edge, A Fateful Fire and the Men Who Fought It. So Kyle Dickman, we spoke a little bit earlier. We mentioned his name a couple times, Eric Marsh. We talk a little bit more about Eric Marsh. He was the superintendent of the Granite Mountain Hotshots. I guess he could be kind of a hard ass, but he kind of had a soft spot for his guys.
Yeah, I think that's a appropriate description. So Eric was a pretty complicated character. He was from Appalachia originally, moved out to the West to fight fires in Arizona, and he sort of moved between fire jobs and out of fire jobs, and eventually decided to apply for a permanent position in the city of Prescott. And at that time, the Hotshots, Granite Mountain Hotshots, were actually a fuels crew, and their job was to go out and thin the brush and forest outside of the edge of Prescott. So when fires did start, they would sit down before the town burned. It was a good job, and it's a really progressive idea, but compared to the glory of fighting fires, it was sort of mundane for Eric. So he spent a number of years trying to take this fuels crew and turn them into the Hotshots, and ultimately, of course, he succeeded in doing that. But the result is he had an immense amount of pride in his crew. And so when he lost, you mentioned earlier that he'd hurt his shoulder at the beginning of the fire season, and he basically stepped way back from the Hotshots in the 2013 season, and he didn't work with the guys at all until actually the day of the Yarnell Hill fire.
And it sounds like he kind of had a chip on his shoulder. Is that off the mark?
I don't think that's off the mark. No, I think part of it was, I think he probably felt like he had to. I think he always felt like he was between a rock and a hard place. I mean, in Prescott, the city firefighters didn't necessarily like the wildland guys. There's, one story one of the guys told me was he'd worked for the city for 6 years, and he went to a Christmas party, and one of the structural firefighters walked up to him and said, "Well, what the hell are you doing here?" So they weren't really well accepted by the city, and they also weren't really accepted in the wildland side of things. And I think Eric felt like he had to protect his men both from the municipal guys and also from the federal and state firefighters.
And we should mention that in his past performance reviews, which are frequent in fire, Eric Marsh had received some mixed opinions. One supervisor said of him, he knows what to do in wildland fire situations. But his interpersonal relations, they got pretty heavily dinged, and he also developed a reputation for inconsistency on the line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he wasn't particularly... He was very insecure, I think, is the right way to put it. And he had a reputation for micromanaging the men. And, on one fire, I think that part of being in this position where he's between a rock and a hard place is he felt compelled to take assignments, higher risk assignments that maybe other hotshot crews wouldn't take, to prove that his men were capable of doing the job as well as anybody else. And so that happened on one fire, and it was called the Horseshoe 2 fire in southern Arizona, and there was all these more experienced hotshot crews there, and they had to burn out this section of line. And Eric Marsh decided that day that although these other crews said it was too dangerous, too risky to do it, Marsh decided that he would go ahead and take the men down there and burn out this piece, which is to intentionally set fire to blacken the fuel so the fire eventually goes out. But they lost the burnout, and I think a lot of hotshot superintendents use that as an example of the type of risky decision making that Marsh had been known for. But I will also say that after 19 men die under your command, I think he was exposed to a lot of scrutiny from other hotshot crews. And so he everybody's just going to pick out these incidents. And it's not uncommon to lose burnout operations. So,
and there was a dynamic that kind of developed in Marsh's absence. As you mentioned, he could be kind of dictatorial and micromanaged. Mm-hmm. And Steed, on the other hand, kind of the cooler older brother.
Yeah, that's right. He was all the men really seemed to love Steed, and I think they all looked up to him. And not just because he was physically tough, but instead of whereas Marsh might punish the men by if somebody makes a mistake, he would single them out and lecture them in front of the whole crew. What Steed would do is say somebody makes a mistake, he would make everybody drop down into the ash and do 50 push-ups, but he would do those push-ups with the men, and I think that earned their respect.
And there's another member of the crew we should meet, and in many ways this story is his story. Brendan Donut McDonough. Tell us about Brendan.
Well, Brendan came to the crew I can't remember. Maybe he was 19 years old, and he recently had a daughter. He had spent some time in jail. He'd been arrested for theft, and he came to the crew in hard times, and he wanted he came up and talked to Eric Marsh, and he was completely candid with him. He said, "Look, I know that my resume isn't that strong, but I promise that if I work for you, that I'll clean up my act." So he did, and he came to the crew, and he was kind of crasser than the rest of the guys. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think in many ways he had a foul mouth and a long rap sheet, and he wasn't all that well accepted. He wasn't very well accepted when he first showed up, because there was all these other community oriented guys, and you know, I think they kind of. He certainly felt that they looked down their nose at him, and he wasn't that fit either. And on hotshot crews, that can be a real, Achilles heel.
This is Radio West. I'm Benjamin Bombard. Our guest is Kyle Dickman, author of the book On the Burning Edge, A Fateful Fire and the Men Who Fought It. Kyle, in your book, you kind of set up the Yarnell Hill fire, and I want to work our way towards it, but you set it up with this other historically tragic fire, the Dude Fire. Is in late June 1990, almost 23 years to the day, actually, before the Yarnell Hill fire. What happened there?
So the fire was burning on the Mogollon Rim, which is the literal terminus of the Colorado Plateau. It's a notoriously dangerous place to fight fire. June 26th was the hottest day in Arizona history. In Phoenix, it was so hot that they had to cancel flights.
They were worried that tires might melt.
Yeah, they didn't know what was going to happen. It was just, you know, it was like 120 some odd degrees, and they didn't. So they grounded all these planes, and so this was the condition of the on the Dude Fire, which started, like I said, on the Mogollon Rim, and it was threatening this little community of houses. And around 2 o'clock, it was burning really intensely, and this thunderhead developed overhead, and it produced, you know, the thunderhead started producing these 40 to 60 mile an hour winds, and the fire just exploded. And it ended up, there were 7 crews working to stop the fire from burning this subdivision. And they were in this, what's called Walkmore Canyon. And there's 7 crews in this Walkmore Canyon. And the Perryville inmate crew was the 5th crew in this line. And when the fire exploded, it started rushing down this canyon. 5 of the crews above the inmate crew stepped into the Bonita Creek subdivision where they were safe. And then Perryville and the crew below them started rushing down out the canyon. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the fire just, you know, like I said, exploded. 100-foot flames sweeping down the canyon, and they end up getting trapped in there, and they have to deploy their fire shelters. And you know, they, you know, 6 of them die in just this absolutely horrific way.
And you note in your book that despite the imminent danger of fires burning around you and fighting fire, wildland firefighters, they do die in the line of duty, but it's kind of a little surprising to learn that despite that danger, there isn't a really high mortality rate in fire.
Yeah, there is not. I mean, I think the fire managers in general do a really good job of keeping firefighters safe. And I think, yeah, I mean, it's really a testament to the safety-oriented mindset of these crews. And so that's why when incidents like Yarnell Hill happen or the Dude Fire, everybody is just so shocked, which, like you said, it's kind of surprising given what it is that these guys do.
And if I'm not mistaken, nearly every day, and certainly after every fire, the agencies get people together to try to learn, right, from what happened that day, what happened on this fire, what can we take away to improve safety and to improve our abilities.
Right. So there's what they're called incident action plans. And so every morning on a fire, they produce these packets that can be, you know, they're like 20, 25 page packets. And they always include safety briefings. What are the hazards that they can expect on the fire that day, whether it's bees or heat or, you know, weather conditions or the fire itself. And the men are constantly discussing the dangers that they can expect. And so a lot of that has come out of these fatalities. So in 1994, 14 firefighters died in the South Canyon fire in Colorado. And those deaths prompted the Forest Service to really look at their practices and say, you know, why did these men die? What can we do to prevent these deaths in the future? And I think it's telling that men and women still die every year fighting mm-hmm. fires, because I think that the job really is so dangerous that you can't successfully mitigate all the hazards. So if you're willing to put firefighters out there to battle these blazes, the unfortunate truth is that we have to expect men and women to continue to die. Mm.
Is it getting more dangerous?
It is getting more dangerous. Yeah, I think that's a fair, I think that's a fair assessment. You know, for a number of reasons. Like, we've been fighting fires successfully since about 1950, and the result of that is that forests that were once relatively thin have now become incredibly dense. You know, so for instance, there's one plot of forest in the mountains behind my home in Santa Fe that used to have 150 trees per acre and now has 1,200. And so that extra fuel is just that. It's extra fuel for the fire. And so the fires are burning more intensely. We're seeing bigger fire seasons that combined with climate change are just creating what's called mega fires. These fires that there's not a lot of evidence that suggests that we're actually successfully controlling these blazes. So I think it's also, again, a testament to the fire agencies that we're not seeing more deaths, because the fires really are getting more dangerous.
So in working our way up to the Yarnell Hill fire, you mentioned some of the conditions that were present at the Dude fire, and some of these conditions were also present in the Southwest in 2013. What was that like? Mm-hmm. What was that year like in terms of weather and expectations for the fire season?
Well, everybody knew it was coming. I mean, they were in year 15 of a drought, and you know, there's plenty of historical records that suggest that right at the onset of the monsoon, which is basically when we start to get our rainfall here in the Southwest, it's the most dangerous time of the year to fight fires, because you have really dry fuel conditions, and then you also have an increasing amount of moisture in the air, which creates thunderstorms. And so when June 30th came around, they'd already seen a number of fires in the week before and the weeks before that were incredibly intense. And I think everybody was kind of on edge, and everybody kept talking about the Dude fire. They said, you know what, the conditions are really starting to look like that 1990 season where we lost six firefighters. And so people were on edge.
And you write about Chuck Maxwell, a fire forecaster based in Albuquerque, and he issued a warning to the firefighters in the Southwest. Things were looking not so hot, and the factors for serious fires were really lining up over the Prescott area.
Yeah, and so he'd actually made that prediction much earlier in the season. So he had looked at fuels, weather, climate, and said that and I think, you know, he had actually said that June 30th was the very worst day in terms of forecasted fire behavior of the 2013 season. And, of course, that's exactly what we saw.
And you mentioned earlier in the program that the Yarnell Hill fire, this is when Eric Marsh returns to the crew. The crew had just finished up another fire. They had 2 days off, and Eric joined the crew again. What would it have been like on the crew with Big Papa returning to the crew?
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, I think it was probably there was some tension, right? I mean, the men had, like I said, they really coalesced around Steed. And so on June 30th was the first time that Marsh was supposed to be acting as the superintendent of the hotshot crew. And I think Eric Marsh probably felt a little bit threatened by Steed. He'd watched this crew that he'd spent so many years building and shaping line up behind his number two in command. And I think that I think happened is that he felt that he needed to win back the admiration of his men, and I think that, so that was sort of the backdrop of what was happening on the 30th.
And these guys had, as you mentioned, they had coalesced under Steed. They'd fought a bunch of fires together. Well, a few. Was it about a handful at that point?
It's about a handful. Yeah. So they had a pretty quiet start to the season, and then they'd been out pretty much all of June, and they'd actually seen some, you know, they started with a small fire, and then they went to a slightly larger fire outside of Santa Fe, and then they stopped what was the Dosey fire. It was burning outside of Prescott, which was a type 1 fire, so the highest priority blaze in the country. And so they'd really seen some pretty incredible fire behavior before they went to Yarnell Hill, but relative to other fire seasons, I mean, they hadn't been quite as busy as a couple of years ago, for instance, where they fought fire for 120 days that year.
And Grant McKee had found a place on the crew finally.
And Grant McKee had finally found a place on the crew. It really happened sort of at the Dosey fire, which was that fire that was burning outside of Prescott. You know, that the hotshots, they stopped an alligator juniper, the world's biggest alligator juniper, from burning, and they were covered in the local paper, and they had you know, people are bringing like donuts and Gatorade and all sorts of stuff by their station just to say thanks. And I think that was the point where he realized that being a hotshot can actually have implications beyond just stopping wilderness fires. I mean, at that moment he realized that things that he was doing on the hotshot crew was actually helping people.
Hmm. That's Kyle Dickman. He's a journalist and a former wildland firefighter. His new book is called On the Burning Edge, A Fateful Fire and the Men Who Fought It. After a break, we'll get to the Yarnell Hill Fire, that fateful day on June 30th, 2013. But we need to take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Benjamin Bombard, sitting in for Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the journalist and former wildland firefighter Kyle Dickman. His new book tells the story of the Granite Mountain Hotshots, an elite wildland fire crew that suffered a great tragedy two summers ago. His book is called On the Burning Edge, A Fateful Fire and the Men Who Fought It. So on June 28th, a Friday, 2013, a lightning strike sets off a fire outside the town of Yarnell. And things got pretty bad pretty quickly. Tell us about mm-hmm. that.
Well, June 28th, the fire hadn't done much. So the fire started, hits this ridge top outside of Yarnell, but it doesn't really grow that quickly. And there's a lot of fires burning in the area. And so an incident commander comes down and makes a decision about whether or not to attack the fire that night. And ultimately they decide not to. They decide to let it burn because it doesn't pose an immediate threat to Yarnell or any of the communities nearby. Over the next 2 days, the temperatures get warmer, gets a little windier, and the fire really begins to grow. And it gets to be at 150, and then I think it's 300 acres mm-hmm. on the morning of the 30th, when everybody starts to realize that this fire is really becoming a threat. And that's the point in which the Granite Mountain Hotshots show up.
And they're the first crew on the scene, is that right?
They're the first hotshot crew on scene and the first crew on scene on the morning of the 30th. Mm-hmm. So on the 29th, there had been, you know, they had attacked the fire. Mm-hmm. A couple of crews had tried to, get it under control, but they were unable to. So they're the first crew on scene on the morning of the 30th.
Okay. And what was Granite Mountain's assignment that day?
Their job was to anchor the fire. That's fire terminology. But the idea is that you have to start attacking a fire by creating line at the very back of it. And so they walked up to the top of that ridge line, and they were going to start building line from what's called the heel of the fire, its ignition point, out and along its flanks and in the direction that it was spreading, which was to the north.
And a gentleman on that day, Gary Cords, he pointed out something to Eric Marsh before they headed out into the field. What was it?
Yeah, so they had a briefing that morning, and they went out. And before the hotshots drove up to that ridgeline, Gary pulled Eric aside and said, "You see this building over here?" And it was called the Helms Place. And the Helms Place was it was sort of a gentleman's ranch. You know, they had like miniature donkeys and llamas, but most importantly, they had defensible space and tin roofs. And the point was is that pretty much no matter what happened, that house, that ranch, was not going to burn. And so what Gary told Eric was that if something happens, bring your crew to this point, and that's your safety zone.
Mm-hmm. And so the Granite Mountain Hotshots are out cutting line, and they post Donut on a lookout assignment. They put him up on he went up to a ridge to mm-hmm. to keep an eye out on the crew. Mm-hmm. He had a trigger point that he was keeping an eye on. If fire crossed that point, he had to bail out. And things were not, as we mentioned before, conditions were developing to be perfect for really intense fire activity that day. And the fire erupted around noon. Take us through what happens after that.
Well, so the fire was burning to the north toward the town of People's Valley. Mm-hmm. It's this little dispersed community. And the idea was they would put Donut down in the valley below this ridgetop. And his job was to serve as a lookout for the crew. And he was supposed to look at what, make sure that no fire started below the hotshots so the fire could, you know, burn up and threaten them. Around 3 o'clock, 3:30 in the afternoon, similar to the Dude fire, a thunderstorm develops over Yarnell Hill, and it starts to produce these enormous, 30, 40, 50 mile an hour winds. And the fire, which had been burning with incredible intensity to the north all day, suddenly pivots and starts running to the south. And so it had what had been a relatively sleepy southern flank of the fire, 2 foot, 3 foot flames, jumps to life, and you get 10 and then 20 and then 30 foot flames that all sort of are sweeping toward the town of Yarnell and directly at Donut and his lookout position. So when that happens, you know, the hotshots, Granite Mountain hotshots, are up on this ridgeline, and they can see everything that's happening. Mm-hmm. And they can see, and Donut gets on the radio, and he realizes that he's either going to have to deploy his fire shelter or get picked up and swept away from the, swept out of the path of the fire. So he rushes back to this little safety zone that's not large enough for him to survive in. And all of a sudden, this guy, from a superintendent of another hotshot crew, gets on his four-wheeler and rushes in, picks up Donut, sweeps him out of danger's path, and brings him back into the town of Yarnell, into the relative safety of Yarnell.
Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, you mentioned this is around 3 o'clock. The Granite Mountain hotshots were taking a break for lunch. They were sitting in the black, as you write. Well, tell us about the black and what they were doing there.
Well, they pulled back into the black after the wind shifted, and so they knew that the fire basically exploded. Things were changing very quickly. The entire focus of the firefight, which had been People's Valley, that little community to the north, became Yarnell. And so they pulled back into the safety of the black to reassess the situation. And from where they were, they knew that there was literally no safer place to be on the fire than that the already burned fuel up on the ridgeline.
And that's because it can't burn again. Is that?
That's correct. Okay. Yeah.
But things were getting hot, and the Granite Mountain hotshots, they made a decision. Something happened up there. They decided to leave the black, and I guess the idea was to head to the Helms place. What compelled them to make a decision like that?
Well, that we don't really know. I mean, what we know is that from the ridge line, the hotshots were in a position that they could see everything unfolding. So I think they had a very good idea that given the intensity of the fire, that they were about to sit by and watch the town of Yarnell burn. And so I think that at that point, they felt compelled to do something. I mean, they could either sit and watch this town burn and do nothing, or they could leave the safety of the black, head out about a mile and a half through unburned fuel back toward the town of Yarnell. And so I guess, what I think, my theory is that they wanted to put themselves at the Helms place, where they would then be in a position to help people whose lives were soon to be destroyed.
And around 4 o'clock, just an hour after they'd settled down in the black for lunch, all hell broke loose with the Yarnell Hill fire, and they started making their way down to the Helms place, trying to cut through the chaparral there. Dense brush, I take it, really is difficult to move through.
Yeah, there was a couple of hikers who had been out there earlier that day, and they described it as too dense for a bear to roll through. Whatever that means, but yeah, it was pretty thick.
Now, I want to get to a piece of tape here, and this is, it's pretty tough to listen to. I got to say, I've listened to it probably more than a dozen times, and every time it chokes me up. But I think it's important to get a sense of what was happening that day. These are the last words of the Granite Mountain hotshots. And we'll hear a few voices here. The first is that of Jesse Steed, Granite Mountain's captain that day. John Abel was running operations on the fire that day. You'll hear his voice. Bob Caldwell was the boss of the Granite Mountain's Bravo squad. You've mentioned him a couple times. We'll also hear John Burfiend. Am I pronouncing that correctly, Burfiend?
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah.
And he was an experienced firefighter manning a DC-10 airplane above the Yarnell Hill fire. A lot of information here, but it helps to understand it. He's alternately referred to as Arizona 16 or Bravo 33. You'll hear his voice a few times. And you'll also hear the voice, finally, of Eric Marsh, Granite Mountain's superintendent. Is there anything else we need to know to listen to this piece of tape?
Yeah, it's worth setting the context for it. So after these guys had hiked out along the green, they dropped down they dropped down into this box canyon, and they lost sight of the fire, and they were about a quarter mile from the Helms place when this radio transmission came through. And at this point, none of the other firefighters on scene knew exactly where the Granite Mountain hotshots were. They thought they were still in the black. So this, which explains some of the surprise in the voices that you're about to hear.
Breaking in on Arizona 16, Granite Mountain hotshots operations, Bravo 33.
Attack, Granite Mountain 7.
Okay, unit that's hollering in the radio, I need you to quit and break operations, Bravo 33.
Okay, Grand Mountain 7 sounds like they got some trouble. Go ahead and get that. She's trying to get you on the radio. Let's go ahead and see what we got going on.
Okay, copy that. I'll get with Grand Mountain 7, man.
Bravo 33, Division Alpha with Grand Mountain.
Okay, Division Alpha, Bravo 33.
I can't tell.
Okay, I'm here with Grand Mountain Hotshot. Your escape route has been cut off. We are preparing a deployment site. Burning out around ourselves in the brush, and I'll give you a call when we are under the shelters.
Okay, copy that. So you're on the south side of the fire then?
Thanks, Bob.
Okay, we're going to bring you the V-LAT, okay?
So Kyle Dickman, what's happening there? What are the Granite Mountain Hotshots doing?
Well, that's literally, I mean, as you said, that's the last transmission, the radio transmission. So that's the last time anybody outside of the crew members heard their voices. What's happening is that they're telling the incident commanders that they're about to deploy their fire shelters, which, and given the fire behavior, given the fact that they have a 30 or 40 foot flaming front racing toward the town of Yarnell, I think what they're telling everybody is that they are in a fight for their lives and most likely worse.
And they busted out their chainsaws and were trying to cut out as much property as they could to get a site, right?
Right. So they were down, like I said, they're in the bottom of this box canyon about a quarter mile from the Helms place. And so what they did is they pulled out their chainsaws and they pulled out what's called fusees, which are flares used to ignite the brush around them because fire can't burn fuel that's already been burned. So they're trying to, they have 2 minutes from the moment that they see the fire to the moment that ultimately, mm-hmm. that the fire hits them and they die. But so they start using their chainsaws and to thin out this brush, deploy their fire shelters. They all huddle in an area about the size of a tennis court. So there's 19 men packed into an area about the size of a tennis court when the flames hit them.
We're running out of time here, so we can't get to some of what happens after that. As you note in your book, Kyle Dickman, chaos reigned that day on the Yarnell Hill fire. And when the smoke cleared, 19 of the Granite Mountain Hotshots were dead. It was the most in a single incident since 1930 and the most firefighters perished in the line of duty since 9/11. And only Brendan Donut McDonough survived. As you mentioned, he'd caught a ride back into Yarnell. And as luck would have it, the monsoon season arrived in full force. Just a day later?
Yeah. I mean, that's a real tragedy is it was raining in the city of Prescott. So in the days that follow, in the weeks that follow, I mean, they were having mudslides and flooding in Yarnell. And, you know, it turned out to be among the wetter monsoons in recent history.
And we talked about it a little bit earlier as well that now the big question was, why did they leave the black? What were they trying to do? And a number of controversies, I guess, have developed around that question. Oh, uh-huh. No, I shouldn't say controversies, pardon, conspiracy theories.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of there was enough gray area in this incident that that I think people were unhappy with whatever the investigations found. So there was two official investigations launched into this incident, one by the state of Arizona, another by OSHA. And the problem was is that there was what the first investigation found was there was a 40-minute radio blackout from the time that the hotshots left the black until that radio transmission that we heard just a few moments ago. And so I think in those 40 minutes, which turned out that there had actually been radio transmissions, but most of the people on scene had forgotten about them in the chaos of the firefight, was all this room for people to speculate about why exactly it is they left the black, and had they received a call from an incident commander to actually go into town? Mm-hmm. Why is it that they decided to make this incredibly high risk decision at the very moment that the fire was burning at the most intense point, the entire day, and in fact, really the entire year?
How did the families deal with this tragedy?
Oh, I mean, exactly as you would expect. I think everybody was just absolutely shocked. Just devastated.
lawsuits and...
Well, there were lawsuits that came... Yeah, correct. I mean, I think I think that most people couldn't understand why they died, and mm-hmm. I think it was easier to assume that rather than saying, look, a mistake had been made, and the mistake being that they decided to leave the safety of the black, there had to be some better explanation for it. And I think it's hard to blame the families for filing lawsuits. I mean, I think that for them, most of the families don't necessarily understand the nature of that job, and they don't understand that it is a high-risk profession, even if you don't see a lot of deaths on the fire line. Mm-hmm. And so I think what they wanted to see was more than whatever financial gains that they would gain out of a lawsuit, which I think was not that much money for the families. What they wanted to see was commitment on the part of the state, federal, and municipal fire agencies that these types of tragedies wouldn't happen again. Unfortunately, if we continue to fight fires like we're fighting fires today, like I said earlier, we have to expect that these tragedies will happen again. That's simply the nature of the profession.
And quickly, what happened to Granite Mountain Hotshots after this?
They were disbanded. So I think, they were a fuels crew, and their job was to prepare the city of Prescott for wildfires, an incredibly progressive idea. And after the deaths, the city was wrought with debt, and they couldn't afford to maintain a wildland division. And I think that it's been a lesson for a lot of other municipalities that may have once considered hosting either a fire crew or a fuels crew, and they no longer feel compelled to do that because they see what happens when you have fire line deaths. I mean, the city is in huge debt.
That's the journalist Kyle Dickman. He's a former editor of Outside Magazine, a former wildland firefighter, and author of the new book, On the Burning Edge, A Fateful Fire and the Men Who Fought It. He joined us today from a studio in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Kyle Dickman, this really is a great book. Congratulations, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Doug Fabrizio is our executive producer. Tim Slover is our technical director. The show is produced by Elaine Clark and myself, Benjamin Bombard. Thanks for joining us.